Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We're in crime today, of course, and we're going to be talking about Jack the Ripper. And we have a guest on that's written a few books, as far as I see, on it. And his latest book came out in April, I believe, of last year, sometime. And it's called Jack the Ripper Suspect, Dr. Francis Tumblety. So, Michael Hawley, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. So, now, we've had several people on to talk about Jack the Ripper. And first of all, let's get a little bit about you. Why did you get so involved in this that you're actually writing books?
Well, the one of the things that I've always had a passion for is research and discovery. And my background, I was a Navy pilot for a while, but also part of my science was that my master's research was in stratigraphy and paleontology. And so I was always into the research and discovery of certain fossils. And I was quite involved with the peer review process with that, with Dr. Batt in this area where I live. And then, so I just love discovery. And also with my family history, I love, I'm a genealogist. So, what happened was in 2009, I had another book that I was waiting for publishing, and it was during the financial crisis. And so, the publisher was kind of hemming and hawing on certain, niche books, and which mine was part of that. So I was, biting at the bit, and I actually saw a show on TV on Mystery Quest about, Jack the Ripper. And what happened was, is that there was a suspect that I'd never heard of, was Francis Tumblety, who was, buried just an hour and a half away from me here in, I'm in Buffalo, New York, and this was in Rochester, New York. And so that, piqued my interest. And the person that, what happened was, is that, Stuart Evans, who has now been doing research for 50 years in the Jack the Ripper, he's one of the top experts. In 1992, someone, that knew him gave him some, Ripper letters, and one of them he'd never seen. And it was a big shock to him because it was from the Chief Inspector Littlechild, who was the Chief Inspector of Scotland Yard's Special Branch at the time, and that who was in the know. He was always in the meetings, even though Special Branch was indirectly involved with the Ripper murders, that he was involved in a famous journalist at the time, George Sims, asked him who he thought Jack the Ripper was. This was a hindsight. So 1888 were the murders, and this was 1913. And he says, well, the Sims said, how about this Dr. D, who was, I believe, drew it. But he said, I'm not sure about a Dr. D, but then here's... he said that, but a Dr. T. Tumblety, and he was he was a very likely suspect. Well, that shocked Stuart Evans because he had never heard of Tumblebee. And so then he started doing his research. In the next 2 years, he found quite a bit of material and had a book, which became quite famous. But then, so then that was what the show was about. And so again, I got involved. And so I found his gravesite. And so I went there and did a little YouTube. But that got me involved. And then I realized by 2009, most of the experts dismissed him really as even a serious suspect, not even a suspect because it was such limited evidence. So, well, time to jump in the business. And so my research was a different kind of style. With physical science, we kind of focus on data. We focus on the physical evidence. And then what we're looking for is to see if someone does a research article that, you know, the arguments used, you know, you have both, the arguments need to be both sound and valid. So a valid argument would be that the evidence follows directly to the conclusion. But if there's limited evidence, cherry picking, then that argument's not sound. And so there was limited evidence. And so both sides had pretty valid arguments. So every time I start searching, I discover new things and, all of it is damning evidence and supporting Stuart Evans. And so in 2016, I had written my book, The Ripper's Haunts, which had a mountain of evidence. And that actually changed the minds, hearts and minds of these experts, especially Paul Begg, who's the big reviewer. And he said that my book was head and shoulders above the rest of the books because of this new evidence. So then I got to do a lecture in Liverpool and Baltimore and some other places. And then lo and behold, there's more and more stuff we've been finding on Francis Tumblebee, which required another book. And then so in the meantime, then we found 900 pages of new sworn testimony, 47 sworn testimonies, which was because of a lawsuit in 1903 on Tumblebee. All these eyewitness accounts of Tumblebee in his last 20 years, and so that's kind of how I basically got involved, and I'm continuing. We're still finding more stuff.
Well, you know, before we get into some of that, I would imagine a lot of the evidence is hard to come by and reliable. And, of course, witnesses, well,
yeah,
it's not going to happen.
Right.
So when you come across different pieces of evidence, how do you judge how much weight you can give it?
Corroboration. I think a beautiful example of corroboration would be what we found out is that there was an interview of a person right after Francis Tumblebee sneaked out of the country back to New York City because nobody saw the murders. And so they actually arrested him on a misdemeanor charge of gross indecency. And he was a rich back then, so he basically posted bail, sneaked out of the country. And then when he got here, then the papers were interviewing people that knew him, and one was this Colonel Dunham, said that he remembered Tumblebee having this collection of uterus specimens during the Civil War. And that would be pretty damning for someone that hears Jack the Ripper had taken the uterus out of two of the women. So that article, a lot of some other experts had looked at it and then basically said that since Dunham had, during the Civil War, he was basically a spy. So he had to be an expert at lying. And so because he was good at lying, therefore he's wrong and we don't have to trust it. And they were saying that there's no evidence to support it. Well, that was in, here's Colonel Dunham saying that he saw Tumblebee gave a medical lecture in 1861 when he came to, the onset of the Civil War. Here's Tumblebee, who's an Indian herb doctor actually at the time, but he claimed that he had surgical experience and he was a surgeon, so he wanted to convince General McClellan at the time that he was a surgeon, so he'd given a medical lecture to the officers, and Colonel Dunham was one of those officers, so he wanted to convince them, and that's what surgeons did at the time. They gave medical lectures with these anatomical specimens that they made themselves. And so what I found out was, since that was about July, August 1861 when the lecture occurred, he was just in New York City, and I found this article that was in one of the New York newspapers complaining about Twombly's office having pictures of anatomical specimens all over his windows, complaining about it. And then nobody had ever seen that. And so then what I found out was, that was 1861, and here's Twombly giving this anatomical lecture. He since had left Washington, D.C., and he made his way to Buffalo, New York, 1863, and which nobody knew since we did this research, is he was hanging out with John Wilkes Booth in 1863 in Buffalo, when Booth was at a theater, and Twombly loved the theater. And this newspaper article talked about this, the Buffalo newspaper saying that Twombly was giving anatomical lectures with thespian emphasis. So we're finding corroborating evidence to support that Twombly had this interest. But also, just the incentive for Twombly to have this collection wasn't because he was just kind of a bizarre character, which he was. It's just that he was trying to convince military officers that he was a credible surgeon, which did not work, but that's another story. So I always look for this corroborating evidence to support that. And then, there's a number of things that we have also.
Michael, this is the police officer, I guess, inside me. The 700 pages, where has this been all this time?
And it was never seen since 1908. What happened was, while I was this last year, actually 2017, after writing The Ripper's Haunts and working on my some more material, I got contacted by a person, a photographer from St. Louis, that he was in his master's program. He wanted to be a director. He was already doing film, being the behind the camera, but he wanted to do the director role. So he said that he wanted to do a little documentary on Twombly, and he knows that Twombly had died in 1903 in St. Louis. And since he was there, do you think there was something that he could find to help him out? And some original material. And I said, well, actually, yes, because what happened was when Twombly died at the Catholic Hospital there, St. John Catholic Hospital in St. Louis, he was there for a month, but what happened is he made out a will. And in that will, he had about $3.4 million of today's value in the New York City bank. But, you know, for the last 10 years of his life, what he did is he lived as a homeless person, yet he still was a millionaire. But when he was there, what he did was he bequeathed about a third of that money to his family members, and he screwed the rest of them. And he would give $10,000 of 1903 money to a niece, and the two brothers got nothing. So he was really quite a vindictive kind of guy. So what happened was when he died, all the family members, they sued the will, basically saying that he was claiming that he was not of sound mind and body, therefore the will is null and void, therefore all family members get equal amount. So that court case lasted for 5 years. And so I told the person, Michael Sanop was his name, I said, if we can find out what the family members knew about Twombly to show that he was not of sound mind and body, that never made the papers, that could be pretty damning for any other things. And then so he went searching, and he had to search in a number of different places, and he found all the state court cases of that case, he found 900 pages of 47 sworn testimonies of Twombly in his last 20 years of his life. Most of it focused on the last few years, but some of it, for example, one of them was a young man that we never knew that Twombly, from 1881 to 1901, would go every Mardi Gras to New Orleans. One thing is we found out nobody knew that he was a hermaphrodite. That was a big shocker. And then, in this case of this young Richard Norris, he admitted that when he was, 1920, he would prostitute for money. And although by the mid-1890s he was working for the police department, or 1880s, actually all the way to 2010, he was working for the police department at the time, and he was actually married, but when he was younger, he would do that for extra money. So Twombly had a big crush on him, basically, and would meet up with him every year. And in 1881, here is 1905, the interview in front of the, with the attorneys in front of the judge, and he was saying that in 1881, when he met Tumbly for the first couple months, Tumbly locked the door on him in his room, took one of his knives. He actually, a month before, he showed Tumbly showed Richard Norris in his travel chest a collection of surgical knives. And then one of those knives he put to his throat and said that, and he was basically going to molest him. So he, just before that time, what he did was that Richard Norris had a cigarette in his mouth. So he pulled the cigarette out of his mouth and he said, there's two things bad for young men, cigarettes and streetwalkers. They should all be disemboweled. And so Scotland Yard never knew about this sworn testimony. This was completely new, even to us. And the person, the archivist that had this material, said the last person that checked this out was 1908.
Hmm.
So there's a bunch more. I mean, it's just filled with information on his narcissism, his antisocial personality behavior. He would really kind of bizarre things that he would do. So it showed that a lot of barbers would not work on his hair because he had these sores that wouldn't go away. And there were hints of neurosyphilis.
And he was quite misogynist, right?
Oh, extremely misogynist. That's the other thing that this 900 pages corroborated. One time, his attorney in Baltimore, Frank Widener, said that in 1902, this is a year before he had died, Tumbly was in his office, and Tumbly would sometimes pass out and faint. You know, he had that kidney and heart disease. But Widener let him sit in his office, and every time a woman would come in, Tumbly would always have a newspaper in his hand. He would put his face, the newspaper in front of his face when a woman would go by. And then he said one time there was a woman sitting in his office. This is Frank Widener. Then Frank Widener said that he had a phone call, and there was only one phone in the building. So he had to leave, and Tumbly was in his office, and that woman was in the office. So Frank Widener left and came back, and that woman was outside the office and asked the woman, why did you leave my office? And she says, well, that man in there, I am afraid of. And he threatened me. His mannerisms scared me so much, so I will not be in that room with that man again. Hmm. And so here's Tumbly. A year before he died, he still has this extreme hatred of women, threatening behavior towards women. And that's the other thing that I found out, some more other threatening kind of behaviors that he had with these women.
Yeah. Did he run for president? No, I'm not. That's right. But, you know, one thing I have to say, how about the, let's go back to his gross indecency charge in the UK. Now, that was for having homosexual acts where he was caught, so probably somewhere in public, which it was still against the law back then. And when I look at that, and I also look at he had quite the relationship with the writer Kane, you know, the guy that was one of the most popular writers at the time, first one to sell a million books. And it was suggested they were having an affair. That they were doing this. So if he's prone to be homosexual, why do you think he was killing women? Because homosexuals aren't gay because they hate women. I mean, he obviously was misogynist and he thought of a woman as a lesser species or something. You know, he had something in his mind that was haywire. But if he was having sex with other men, why would he care about killing the woman in these ways?
Well, a couple things. One is that you know how some people will say that, let's say, for serial killers, that if they are gay, they tend to go after young men. But that's more on a sadosexual, as a sexual impulse, and also you'd be a younger man when your sexual desires are greater. Tumbly was different. What he was, he had this extreme hatred, and not of all women, only widow or maid. He hated women that could lure young men away from their intended lovers, as in him.
Oh.
And this is what I have a number of testimonies. I actually have some of those in my book, but of him doing that. And then I found a pattern throughout there. And there was a forensic scientist, criminal profiler, if you know him, Dr. Brent Turvey. What he did was he looked at the victim, Jack the Ripper victims, and what he did not find, and also Dr. William Eckert, neither of them found any sadistic behavior, because they could see that these women were, they were first killed and then they were mutilated. It wasn't that there was a sadistic behavior. It was, and so what Brent Turvey said is he saw two things. He saw anger retaliatory, hatred in the motive, and he also saw reassurance oriented. And with that anger retaliatory, that fits Tumblety to a T. Tumblety hated, attractive women, especially prostitutes, because Tumblety always hung out in the slums, every city he went to, and he would always, that's exactly where the prostitutes were, and he hated them. And then, what happened, though, is Tumblety, around 1880-1881, there was a complete change of behavior. He changed how he traveled. He always traveled to places that had hot baths, and he would, so he stopped his business. So before he, he had six autobiographies. So his first autobiography, just after the Civil War, he was bragging about his Indian herb doctor business. But then the next one had said there was absolutely zero references to Indian herb doctor. It was all about surgeons, because he believed he was the disciple of Abernathy, who was this British English surgeon. And then so, but one of the things is that that match, that hatred, is what Tumblety would have. So with Brett Turvey was talking about is any serial killers that are anger retaliatory, the idea of being gay doesn't fit. It's more you're blaming, let's say, for example, this is not Tumblety, but let's say, you hate your mother, so you're going to kill people that look like your mother, something to that effect. But for Tumblety, it was there was a switch that was flipped. And it could very well have been connected to this his syphilis that he would likely had with the neurosyphilis, or it's just what they call that narcissistic impulse, that rage. Because what he said was, is in the year of the murders were 1888 in the autumn. In the January 1888, he told the Toronto Reporter that he was in constant dread of sudden death because of kidney and heart disease. And so that kidney and heart disease, and here's Jack the Ripper, took three organs out of these women, the kidney, the heart, and the uterus twice. And here's we have Tumblety reported to have a collection of uterus specimens, and then he had this reason for the kidney and heart. And then so it was more as what kind of conforms to what Dr. Turvey says, as opposed to a sadosexual thing. So, but I always tell people, it's like, I'll never be 100% convinced of anyone. If Jack the Ripper was sadosexual, Francis Tumblety is not your man. Right. But what I see, same thing as what Dr. Turvey sees, is I don't see any sadistic behavior, and I do see this. He attacks what makes women different than men in a way.
Well, what did he, when you said he basically had both sex organs, so he had, do you know what he had?
Well, as a matter of fact, we have the sworn testimony of the Undertaker.
Oh, wow.
And this was quite the shocker. A couple things. One is that another New Orleans attorney, Robert Simpson, had given sworn testimony that in his office, Tumblety had passed out and his pants fell down. Oh. And he saw that his hips looked like a woman, and all of them said that his penis was the size of the tip of your thumb, and that even the Richard Norris, the one that got molested by him, told him that he gave the whole story about it was about the tip of the size of his thumb. So he got on the bed, and this is Norris talking, so it's like he wanted Norris to penetrate him. But then the attorney was saying that he had male shoulders, he was tall, looked male, but then he had small female hands, his voice was high-pitched female-like, and his hips were female, and he had this thing. So when they revived him eventually, They also heard rumor by the police in Baltimore that he was a hermaphrodite. So he directly asked Tumbley, and Tumbley told him that's something that has cursed him all of his life. And so then the Undertaker had said that it was the strangest thing he ever seen of this man, because he had never seen anything like it. The legs were straight, so he didn't open up to see any kind of vaginal things, but he saw the penis was really small. And then he was clean in the face. And one of the things that Tumbley had since age 30, in his 30s, he would wax his mustache completely black since his 30s. And then what happened was the Undertaker said that when he cleaned his mustache and his hair was completely white, his mustache, and one of his mustaches popped right off. And there was this big sore under there. And there was a big sore in his throat as well. And that was the thing, is there the number of the barbers would say that these sores that would never go away.
Oh, sexy. Now, one thing now, a lot of ripperologists had said the problem with Tumbley was his age. How do you answer that?
Same thing as still, again, with Dr. Turvey. When you're looking at sadosexual, this sexual desire and drive, that's at peaks at 19 to 30. But in this case, with anger retaliatory, this hatred, and when he, in 1888 is when he was convinced, you know, he was in constant dread of sudden death. And he was Catholic. And what I have a couple things in the book talking about, he always said that women were the curse of the land. And back then, a lot of Catholics incorrectly, misogynistically believed that it wasn't Adam that committed the original sin. It was Eve deceiving Adam. And so Tumbley was in that group where would blame that. So all the disease, all the curse of the land, you know, because the original sin has caused all the negative things, like diseases. So he blamed the women. And then in this case, here he's having this case. And what was your question? Because I was going to go right into that.
His age.
Oh, his age. And so what happens is that is the time in the mid-50s where he is now worried that he's going to die. And he believed, and he hated getting older, but it would be right at the time for anger retaliatory, that hatred, that attack, that mutilation. And then what you're looking at also, if it was neurosyphilis really at the time that was happening, in the 1880s, you see his behavior changing. So then with what we see is after 1893, all he did was stayed in the slums, wore this thick coat, never showered, and here it is from 1893 to, or in 1895 at least, to 1902, stayed in the slums, move around all the time, and he still had...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Upwards of $3 million in the bank. And so you could see his behavior was just completely changed. So his mind wasn't perfect anyway. So it wouldn't be a case of, let's say, a sadosexual serial killer that continues to kill or started early or whatever, has this burning desire. And what he also said, Dr. Turvey said, is with anger retaliatory, if they almost get caught, that tends to stop them. And he almost got caught. But he did not leave England, by the way, because of being suspected of the Ripper murders. That was all because of his gross indecency.
Right. It was because of his, you know, behavior and arrests and stuff. Well, what about his looks? Like, he didn't really fit any of the descriptions at the time. So did he disguise himself or something? Because were the mustache maybe fake? Did he just pop them off?
No. There are a couple things. First of all, nobody saw the murders.
Okay.
So that means there really isn't any eyewitness testimony.
Yeah.
But what we do see, and you have interviewed Tom Westcott.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And then Tom and I, we work well together, and I enjoy Tom's books. And then, but one of the things with the suspects is that when you look at all the suspects, they do vary. And I do have two accounts in the book about very tall suspects. But in the case, remember, there was this thing called the Innocence Project that the School of Law at Yeshiva University did. And what they did is they took 239 cases where there was a conviction based on eyewitness testimony. So eyewitness testimony caused the conviction, meaning the person that gave the eyewitness testimony was convinced enough to allow this person to go to jail. And 73% of those were overturned because of DNA evidence. Here it is, 73% of 239 cases modern day. So as an eyewitness testimony, basically, and then this is like that you can't count upon it as well.
Right.
So so what for me is that if you look at some of the suspects, even when we have one of the things that I never do is I never go against any other suspects because I love it. To me, it's all about reliable knowledge. Everybody needs to research all these people and keep on researching with proper peer review as best we can to get the bigger picture, because I don't believe we'll ever find definitively who's Jack the Ripper, because even the ideas of DNA just can't work. So, but we're getting closer and closer and finding more and more about it. So, but when you look at a lot of the even the hindsight with some of the Scotland Yard officials, that even with Swanson and even with Anderson, they're basing it on eyewitness testimony. Well, here we're finding out that eyewitness testimony, even though you're convinced that that person's convinced, they might not have seen Jack the Ripper. That might have been another John. In a lot of cases where, let's say, somebody was with that, you know, they don't know for sure if that was the particular prostitute or unfortunate. And that if it was, maybe Jack the Ripper waited for they did their business and then he attacked. And so we don't know for sure. So with eyewitness testimony, it's, you know, I don't think that is a big issue with Tumblebee.
One thing I wanted to get into was, now what kind of doctor was he? Like, you talk about the Indian herb and you talk about different things, but I also see in his history that he was supposed to be, you know, a pretty popular doctor and won an award, right? He was awarded the cross of the Legion of Honor, right? So, so he was a what was he like? Was he a surgeon, a doctor?
Well, he never went to medical school, and so what happened was is in 1847 he was not. Some people were thinking that he was raised in Rochester, New York. No, he was raised in Ireland, and I found out where he was in Ireland. And then, so at age 17 is when, during the peak of the potato famine, is when he came over on a famine ship. Some of his family members were already here. He was the 11th child. So mom and dad, he came with mom and dad, but some of the older brothers and sisters were already here. And that's why he went to Rochester, because that's where some of them were. And then so, when he got here, by 1850, there was this French disease doctor who called himself Lispinard, because that's a French name, but his name was Reynolds. But he was actually, you know, for curing French diseases, sexual diseases, and Twombly was his work for him. And Twombly would go to different cities and kind of, you know, get his material in some of the city directories, and he would travel for him and do things for him. But then 1853 is when this Indian herb doctor, this charismatic guy named R.J. Lyons, came into Rochester and opened up an office right next to Lispinard's office. But Lispinard had one of these smaller building. This was the big arcade building. And back then it was a huge mall at the time. And it was like, it was expensive. And here's R.J. Lyons, just very charismatic, and he would have lines of people. And it attracted Twombly immediately. That was 1853. By 1856, Twombly is on his own across the border into London, Ontario, opened up his first Indian herb doctor office. And it was actually the first time we have record of him being nasty to a female patient as well. But then he went through Canada, and by 1860, he had over $1 million in the bank of today's value. He was so good at it. He would go into cities circus style. He was like the P.T. Barnum of the day, and he would go in there, and he was just a bright, brilliant guy. He was charismatic. He would attract the rich people, and that. But he had these things. He had these young men that he would kind of molest, but also that he had this misogyny that you could follow. And then so he was basically trained as an Indian herb doctor, which is an herbal guy, but it was more. It was a scam as well. So back then, allopathic medicine was actually nasty. It hurt when you went to the doctor. It was better out than in. But herbal medicine made you feel better. They claimed it cured all. Twombly always claimed he could cure everything, but it really couldn't. But it just made you feel better. And so initially that made, you know, the people would go to him. But then by the time they realized he was a quack, he was gone to another city, and he's got all this money. And he continued to do that process. He would go city to city to city. And so, but what happened was he would always put MD at the back of his name. And so he claimed that he had medical experience. And so then he actually got in trouble a couple times because in court they showed that he did not go to medical school. This was 1860. He had a court case. But then 1861, here's where he's going to Washington, D.C., right after the first battle of the Bull Run, and he's trying to convince the General McClellan that he's a surgeon, that he should be, you know, commissioned. That would be a coup, because what would happen was because he never had any medical school, if McClellan hired him as a surgeon, that's like bypassing med school. Now you are an official surgeon. So even in his autobiography after that, he talks about that he, you know, was going to help out General McClellan, but then he decided not to, or something to that effect. So then he claimed in the late 1860s, he went to France, and that's where he got this medal and helped out as a surgeon, as ambulance stuff. And he also said that he was, as I said, that he said claimed to be a disciple of Abernathy, who was an English surgeon. And the difference, he said that he was kind of a surgeon on steroids, meaning don't go use the knife first. Because back then, you know, prior to bacteria, you know, antibiotics, you know, half the time they would die. So in this case, what he would do is he would say medicine first, and then the last, if that nothing else works, then use the knife. That's kind of what Tumbly was trying to say. And then, this new 900 pages of eyewitness testimony, when he was on his deathbed or near his deathbed that first month, the person that would come visit one of his doctors, Tumbly would have conversation with him about surgery, amputations. And so the attorney asked that surgeon if Tumbly had medical knowledge, and that surgeon says absolutely, and he was very interested in surgeries such as the amputations. And so you could see Tumbly. Then when you look at his autobiographies, he wanted to, even when he was retired, he always said that he was the son of a surgeon, which he was not. But, and also he was a retired surgeon from the English Army, the British Army, which he was not, but that he already had the money, so he loved to be considered the Dr. Tumbly.
Wow. Do you think that his, like, mental problems, like, do you think that he had issues, like, you know, obviously he was sick with something. Do you think this is the reason it affected his mind, and that's why he didn't use any of the money he had?
At the end, I mean, he did at the beginning, especially he would spend a lot of money to make money when he was in his business. And so he'd always advertise, spend the money, but it made him a lot of money. But by the 1800s, then we see it's like it's silent because he's no longer advertising. And anytime we'd see him in the papers when he got in trouble, let's say he got arrested for sodomy, it's something to that effect, like Toronto in 1881, he got arrested for sodomy. So in these cases, and so he was, but by 1888, he still wore pretty good clothes. And his Baltimore attorney has said that he started becoming his Baltimore attorney about 1894. And he said that Tumbly was wearing regular clothes, old clothes. But by 1898 to 1900 is when he stopped. It was all these, it was kind of disgusting kind of clothes. Or it was just this thick coat kind of thing that he would wear. And then he'd walk around, and even a New Orleans attorney said that he didn't want to be with Tumbly, but Tumbly would talk him into going to lunch with him. And Tumbly would be taking a fork and scraping his beard. And then what he would do is he would have his attorney read his autobiography, the good parts, over and over and over. So, but yeah, it was. So you could see that the mind was kind of a strange something. Something changed, especially after he got back from England.
Yeah, something's going on. So, what convinces you the most? What of all the evidence or all the research you've done and the papers and stuff? What item kind of throws it over the edge for you?
Well, the first thing is when I first started, all it was is the interest of him was that when I first heard that he had this uterus collection, I thought, well, that's pretty strange for people to have, and that he had this hatred of women. But it was at the time where the other experts were saying that there is no evidence of that. So that's why I got involved. And so then I was interested in to see if that's happening. And every time I turn over a stone to find new evidence, it's always damning. And then so with the first book, The Ripper's Haunts, it's actually I wrote it not to try to show that he was Jack the Ripper, but just that he was a – Scotland Yard considered him a serious suspect. And that actually has worked. And my goal is always to keep – not that he's Jack the Ripper – but he could very well be the damning parts. And the couple of things that kind of were stunners to me is here it is. I'm almost done with writing Jack the Ripper suspect Dr. Francis Tumbledy. The goal there was to get into find out more about his history. If I could find, especially with serial killers, serial offenders, we know that, you know, even if psychopathic behavior or sociopathic behavior, it starts when they're young. You know, psychopath more is a, you know, the bad egg effect, but there's generally abuse there. So I'm going through all of his life to find out if I can find any of this stuff. And then so in the pattern fits quite well in a lot of times, a lot of cases. But what really kind of shocked me was when I found out that when we discovered this new material, here it is that Richard Norris said that, you know, Tumbly showed him his surgical knives and said that all streetwalkers should be disemboweled, and that was 1881. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Scotland Yard never knew this. And before I even, you know, like, I almost was done with this book. And so this 900 pages could have had a ton of material that just pretty much canceled Tumbley out. It could have said, no, he was really, he told us that he was lying. You know, all that could have happened. But so this material, the other thing is this material, I passed it on to one of the top experts is Paul Begg. And because one of the things about being a suspect ripperologist is people automatically think that you're biased. And that's okay because all humans are biased. And so what I purposely want to do is I want to have people like Paul Begg look at it and do book review and rip me apart and look for the bias. And since he knows so much about Jack the Ripper, there's few people that know more about that him, that if it passes the muster with him, also Tom Westcott, the person you interviewed, yeah. The guy just knows so much about it. And so he had actually done a book review of mine as well. And it's exciting to get positive book reviews like that.
Oh, so. Yeah. No, it's good to hear good things from people that have different points of view, you know, or
yeah,
a lot right. of information, stuff mm-hmm. like that. So what other response are you getting? Like, how's the public in general dealing with this? Do you hear anything from people?
Actually, a few things. One is I just received 2018 the book of the year for this book, and it was actually a group of experts, and which is quite I like that because this is a suspect book, and usually experts like to give more of a general expert. You know, like Tom Westcott. If you look at his books, you know he knows so much about the whole picture, and so he doesn't focus on any specific suspects like I do, and then so. They tend to avoid suspect books to be like that way, and I got that. So I was pretty exciting about that. And then, but once on January 22nd, I'll be on the Travel Channel with a new series called Legend Hunter, and they sent me to the UK to interview me for that. And so it was exciting to have that. And so what's happening is the material that's discovered, it's really – in the expert community that have already done a lot of peer review in these books. And what's fun to me is that there's always debate. So everyone has their opinions and expert opinions, and I love that challenge. And then so it's getting a very positive responses. And as again, so the public I do, definitely. Anybody that I've communicated with are really interested in this material. So it's the experts as well that actually are connected with the public, like another Rippercast with Case Books, Jonathan Menges. He's interviewed me a number of times, and he knows so much about this material. And he really purposely didn't tell me any questions, and he was drilling me with questions. It was so fun because, you know, if it's not correct, then I want to know about it so I can kind of fix it. To make sure that it is correct, you know. So it's really, the goal is reliable knowledge to understand the truth behind everything. So any kind of inaccuracy, it has to get filtered out.
I would say probably the biggest problem or the largest problem is that the investigations at the time were probably not. They didn't leave you with a whole lot of information.
Yeah, you're right. As I was saying, especially like what recently we found out about eyewitness testimony with the Innocence Project, they did not have fingerprinting at the time. They did not have fiber analysis. Of course, they did not have DNA analysis. Either beat a confession out of you. But we've actually have over a dozen. We all have over a dozen confessions. So which one's right? But it's exciting as kind of from a history perspective, as in learning more and more about it, as like, you know, Tumbley really was on the mind of Scotland Yard. And then so to find out more about what was going on really kind of helps the bigger picture, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Much more reliable. Your book and information has been great. We've had some real wingdingers on. You know, so this is it's good to get someone that's looking at more information, more fact.
Well, what's interesting is post book. I have, you know, there's enough material for another one, and so I'm working with Brian Young, who's an expert in the area. But we have cool things that Tumblety was actually in communication, possibly patient of an alienist in New York City, which is basically a psychiatrist or a neuroscientist at the time in New York City. And that person was the son of the man that was the Surgeon General at the time, that people had asked him who was another alienist, that you know, what they thought, who they thought the personality profile for Jack the Ripper was. And so here's the son, who was actually an alienist as well. Graham Hammond is his name. William Hammond was the Surgeon General. And so here's Graham Hammond having a relationship, communication with Tumblety. So you could see something was going on, because Graham Hammond was an expert at the diseases of the brain. And then I found out we could really get conspiracies going, because the year before the murders, Graham Hammond was in medical school, at teaching medical school, and he claimed that he could hypnotize any one of you medical student to kill somebody. So this was in a medical report, and it shows that Graham Hammond hypnotized this guy and made him go crazy, just like this rage. And so here it is. Oh, that'll be a perfect maybe a fiction novel where he did it with Tumblety.
Yeah, he's
but we're actually finding more things that happened when Tumblety came back, when a Scotland Yard detective followed him, and then what the investigation in the United States was about. Tumblety was actually arrested in February 1889 on the Ripper murders in New Orleans. And that's another thing. Don't tell anybody, by the way.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
Yeah, good luck. what's your contact information that you want people to have in case they happen to see Jack the Ripper at the time? Maybe an eyewitness is still alive.
Oh, that would be my hub that I use as my website is michaellhawley.com. And then when you go on there, you'll see how you can get a hold of me. You know, like, you know, I'm on Facebook, and then it's got my email on there. And so that's probably the quickest way, I would say, is to contact me through that.
So any plans coming up next for you?
Yes, couple things. I do have a book signing lecture Tuesday coming up here locally. And then I said on January 22nd, I have going to be on the Travel Channel. And then an Irish film director, Jason Figgis, is coming to America. And he asked me to help him out with doing a documentary on Tumblety. So that's 2019. We have done a screenplay as well. And that there is some interest in that as well, but based on my book. But it's going to be a fiction kind of thing. But so the biggest thing would be probably another documentary coming up. Yeah. And then so.
Well, fantastic. Well, what can I say? Michael Hawley, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Al. It was excellent, and I enjoyed speaking with you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.